Stephen Malcolm Ronald Nice is better known by his stage name, Steve Harley. Steve is one of the most enduring names in the music business, probably best known for his song Come Up and See Me with his band Cockney Rebel. He also works as a solo artist. He'll be releasing a new single from the latest album on September the 19th. Let's have a listen to the single first, and then we'll hear from Steve himself. From the album Uncovered, this is Out of Time.
You don't know what's going on. Been away for far too long. You can't come back and think you are still mine. You're out of touch, my baby, my poor old-fashioned baby. I said, baby, 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 you're out of time.
It's a little bit hard to know where to begin with you, Steve, because you've done so much for so long. So can I ask you, beginning, what's the highlight of the whole thing?
Oh, gosh.
Start with a simple question.
Yeah. There's no simple answer. In 47 years, cracky. There's been so many great moments because if you know how I work on stage, we encourage great moments. You know, it's such a celebration when I play. I love audiences. I just love the whole idea. I love backstage. I love dressing rooms. I love sound checks. I love traveling. The whole lifestyle is in me. And at the moment, of course, in these very strange times, without a ticket in my desk and without an itinerary, I don't really know who I am. So it's all very confusing. But highlights, I don't know, man. I've played 3 Glastonbury's, 2 Isle of Wights, hundreds and hundreds of festivals to tens of thousands of people, and everyone's a highlight, to be honest. It's when you got, no matter who it is, 500 at one of my acoustic shows, or 20,000 outdoors, and when you know, we finish Sebastian, which they're not used to, that kind of music, and when we finish them, Make Me Smile, and you see everyone singing it, you know, you know we film them, and it's like, that's another highlight. I'm so sorry to ramble and not really give you a specific answer, but it would be like us having 5 kids and saying, who's your favorite?
I was going to ask you the secret of how you're able to pure spark.
I still feel kind of privileged to have these audiences, David, to be honest. I don't take it for granted. I'm no sycophant. I don't get too involved online with them all. There are some hardcore followers, you know, and you know, have to keep, I like to keep my audience at arm's length, because I'm also very private in my life. You know, I don't court. Remember, I trained for 4 years as a newspaper reporter. I don't court the press. I know it comes up and kicks you back on the backside eventually if you court the press. I don't do that. They come to me, and that's fine, but we don't court the press. And so I'm pretty private. And so when that hit, I only come alive when that light hits me. I'm on the street. People do come up to me. I don't spend a lot of time on the street, to be honest, all through my life. But people do come up to me, and I don't mind. I'm fine with that, as long as they go away quickly and don't want to shake hands and stuff. But I've always been like that. This lockdown thing is nothing new to people like me. Michael Jackson wasn't entirely insane wearing that surgical mask all the time, you know. I've been refusing to shake hands for 30 years. It's where you pass germs on, and I don't want their colds. I'm a singer. It's what I do for a living. I've got, you know, they go home to bed with their cold. I don't. I go to a hotel room, and next day I've got to do it again. I need my voice. I need 100% good health. I actually haven't had a cold for 30, my wife says it's 32 years since I've had a common cold, and it's hard work, but you have to do it. It's part of the discipline of taking your job seriously. And so I'm on the street, or an airport, you know, people do approach me sometimes, but I really travel. I look more like a geography teacher than a rock star. You know, I only come alive as a rock star when that light hits me. I've seen one or two very famous faces in public, and they are dressed and prepared as though they're going to walk out on stage, and they're walking down the high street, and it's pathetic. It's really sad. Drawing attention to yourself. Wicked. Oof. No, thank you.
Now, you've obviously been successful in the music business. Do you have any unfulfilled ambitions? Are there things that you still wanted you haven't done?
Oh, there's a bucket list, but they're nothing to do with music. I've got everything I want in that, you know, as long as I wake up in the morning saying, God, give me a voice and give me an audience, it's all I need. Playing live, you know, when I work, 12 people work, and the theatres work, and you know, so that's another part of the privilege of, you know, sharing it with other people, helping their lives, you know, their income and everything. I mean, hundreds of thousands of great players and actors and stuff are out of work. They're earning nothing. They're earning not a penny. I don't know how they survive.
Is there anything on your bucket list you can tell us about?
Well, I keep telling everyone when they ask me, I've got to go through the Panama Canal. I've got to do that. It's just ridiculous not to do that. I've seen so much of the world, but you know, and I lived in LA for a long time, but I've never been through the Panama Canal. I've got to do that. That's since you're asking. That doesn't sound very exciting, but it will be. I'm not going to make a thing of it. I'm going to fly out to one side, take the ship through, and fly back again. One night in Panama City, and that's it. You know,
it's not sounds a like big... a song. One night in Panama City.
Once I've been there, I might get the song. I'm intrigued by the Panama Canal, the engineering and its history, and thousands of men that died building it. It's a fantastic hit story, frankly. And there's other things, but at the moment, we should have been in Helsinki and Belgium and Holland all over the summer, and frankly, I don't want to get on a plane at the moment. I don't understand how you know, you can do so many things, especially in a restaurant, which we've done a few times with my family. But you get, they get on aeroplanes. I mean, who wants that? I don't want that. I'm not doing it. Not until this bug has been sorted out. I'm not getting on a plane. I'll play in Europe. We can do that by road, you know? Mm-hmm. But I don't want to fly anywhere. Panama is on hold. Indefinitely.
I was intrigued to find out that as a child you were quite poorly, but as a result you read things like D.H. Lawrence.
I might have got hold of a copy of something by D.H. Lawrence at that age, but it wasn't with the literary prose. Certainly I didn't have the level of maturity that I could appreciate anything like that. Was that a kind of one of the better byproducts of being a little bit poorly?
Yeah, I was not poorly. I understand what you mean. I was as fit as a flea, and I still am, strong as an ox. But I had polio in 1954 when there was an epidemic. So that's if you say I was poorly, yeah, sure, I was at death's door for a few days. I know about all that. But then when they, you know, I wasn't unwell otherwise, other than that, if you take my point. I'm sorry, I'm just kidding.
I thought it was something that laid you flat out, but I don't really know at all about it. It was hospital for a length of time.
Yeah. Two sojourns of a year, lots of 3 and 6 months. My mother used to tell me it was about 3.5 years that I was away from the family. In toto, that's between the age of 3.5 and 16 when I had the last piece of invasive surgery.
Do you think that allowed you in a certain way to mature a little bit quicker, maybe other people?
What it did, yeah, and it was very odd. I'd come home when I was 9, 11 years old. I'd come home after 3, 5 months. Because back then, anything that you had done, you know, any surgery at all, your physiotherapy took weeks and months. They send you home now. It took forever. Yeah, and I'd come home, and I remember being about 11 or 12 and going into the sitting room, and my mum and dad's rather large, they had a big Victorian flat we lived in, and I'd go into the sitting room, and I'm the second eldest of five, so there's three younger brothers, and I remember asking my dad, is it all right if I sit here? Isn't that weird? I didn't know if it was someone else's place, seat, one of my brothers or his, my dad's. I didn't know because I'd been away again for so long, and I had to ask where I could sit. Isn't that weird?
We'll hear more about Steve Harley's experiences in hospital in a moment. It's not what you might think. But first, let's have a listen to another track off his solo album, Uncovered. This is I See a Face.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just the girl for me, and I want all the world to see we've met. Oh. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way, and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight. La da 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 da. Falling, yeah, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I have never known the likes of this. I've been alone and I have missed things and kept out of sight. But other girls were never quite like this. La da 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 da. Falling, yeah, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me, I want all the world to see we've met. La da 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 da. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way, and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight. la da 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 da. I'm falling, yes I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I'm falling, yes I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again.
I was in a children's hospital and I had a tutor, and it wasn't when I was 12 that I discovered all that literature. It was when I was 15. I was doing the O-level syllabus. I was in hospital from January to December. So I got out. They sent me home to do some of the O-level in a private room at school in the summer. But I was finishing the curriculum. My school, Haberdashers Asks, in South London, was sending the syllabus down to the hospital, and I was romping through it with my tutor because I was alone. I wasn't in a class of 25 kids at the grammar school. I was alone with her. So we got it all done pretty sharpish. And then she would say to my tutor, my school, look, Stephen's romping through this, and, you know, I need to keep him occupied. So my head of English department, who is still to this day a very close friend of mine, a great confidant of mine, he was sending down stuff that was extracurricular. He said, look, Steve, I think you'll enjoy this. He knew my love of words, and he knew my love of Shakespeare. We were doing Othello for O-level and John Donne poetry, and he knew how much I loved it all. And he sent me his own books. He'd send me The Sun Also Rises, Hemingway. He sent me The Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck, and D.H. Lawrence poetry with a lot of what Hemingway talked about Lawrence and said, I don't need to use those $10 words. He said, I know those $10 words, but I don't need to use them. I mean, if you read Lawrence, you need a thesaurus and a dictionary next to you. For a Yorkshire miner's son, you know, boy, he had a vocabulary. That was what changed everything. It certainly, and also, you know, I'm still very, when I say I'm private, I spent all that time, all those years, remember, I explained this to my children. My son is in his mid-30s, but when he was a young man, he was asking me about this and about that, and I said, well, don't touch that, but leave that, I need to know that's there. And I explained to him, I said, it only occurred to me then that I'd spent all those years where beside the bed was a brown wooden cabinet with a bunch of grapes and a bottle of Lucozade on top. And inside that cabinet was everything, was my life, my world. It had the books, the notebook, the pens. It had everything of mine because that's all I had. There wasn't a bedroom. I was in a hospital ward with 11 other boys, you know. So it made me kind of secretive, not in a malicious way at all. I'm not at all malicious, but it made me guarded. Yeah.
Interesting.
Of course, we're all informed. I don't know where you grew up or what you did growing up, David. I don't know anything about your private life, but we're all informed, aren't we, by influences through childhood, adolescence. You know, when you're 15 and you discover girls as a boy, and your mates are lads, that then you start getting influenced again. I mean, I left my my friends were from Asks from school, and then when I was 17, 18, and a young reporter, I met other people who were nothing like my own young friends, nothing like them. They were from different backgrounds, different influences, and they then became my friends and are my friends to this day. My friends to this day, if I needed to call five different people, four of them are still in Fleet Street, as it were. They went on to do very, very well as journalists, and are still my mate. One's editor of the Daily Mirror, one's the news editor of the Sun, and one's a publisher. And they're all trained at the same time as me as reporters, and they're from completely different backgrounds to me. Well, one's not, One's a Cockney boy, and he's a good friend of mine.
Do you think these things in life are almost preordained, or just in your mind just a kind of haphazard?
Well, I'm a fatalist, which means I can relax, because it means that one door closes, another door will open. Sorry for the platitude, but it's a fact. I don't dwell on losses. I really do not. Other people do. They go, oh, no. And I go, well, this is just a loss. Forget it. You know, hey, there's the 3:15 at Kempton to consider. We'll win again, you know. There's always another door opening for me. And I'm very positive about life. But you can't, I don't know if it's preordained. I certainly used to say to Dorothy, my wife, I certainly said to her many, many times, not so long ago, I haven't said it for a long time, but I could say it today. I used to say to her privately, I'd say, yeah, I really actually think I was put on earth to look after you. Isn't that weird to say that to someone? She lost her mother when Dorothy was only 3 years old. And she kind of grew up being looked after by two aunties who just died this year, both of them, and her wonderful dad who died too young. And I don't know, we all just looked at her and said, I think I was put on earth to look after you. You know, we met and it was fate. And we're still together, still good friends. And now we've got two children, and I look at them and think, you know, I'll tell you one day that I think I was put on earth to look after your mum, and look what she gave me. You two wonderful people are they. They're wonderful people, my kids. You know, very lucky, very fortunate. But yeah, preordained, I've no idea. It's a bit metaphysical for me.
Steve, just to wrap up, can you back to the album, Uncovered, and I just wanted to tell us a little bit about it.
I've never been more proud of a recording than this, to be honest, ever. You know, the original Cockney Rebel was very interesting. I mean, the Human Menagerie for a debut album. I've played it on stage with the orchestra and choir half a dozen times, and I realised that we were quite inventive. My head then was extremely imaginative, extremely, and I took a lot of risks, a lot of risks. Don't do it, I'm play safe now. But so there's that. But as a recording, I've never made a record like this. It's, you know, I went into, there's 11 tracks, 9 of them are, people call them covers. I like to say they're interpretations. And 2 are original songs of mine. They're songs I've always wanted to perform. I think they're songs I've sung at home for donkey's years on the guitar when I'm warming up and practicing. They're all sensationally clever, brilliant pieces of work that, you know, anyone like me, I've published 140 songs. And if you've done that, if you sing someone else's song, it's a song that you wish you'd written. This is plain and simple as that, frankly. And they're all fabulous pieces of work. And I went in with the great Martin Simpson. It's just the master of roots music, greatest acoustic guitar player in Britain, one of the best in the world. So once Martin was on board, a great hero of mine, then I got in a jazz rhythm section, plus Barry Wickens, who is a phenomenal, a virtuoso musician from my band, and the great Matt Butler, as the engineer. We went down to Rockfield for a couple of weeks. And the thing is with this album, you put it on and play it, hopefully on a good sound system, and there's no EQ. There is no EQ on this record. Someone said to me the other day, I understand there's no EQ on your voice. I said, my voice? There's no EQ on this record. My engineer, so I've got the best engineer money can buy, and I'm saying to him, don't engineer. And he loved it. Matt just said, fantastic, Steve, we can do that. Because the argument I had was, look, we're in the best studio money can buy with the best Pro Tools equipment that money can buy. I've got the best engineer that money can buy. I've got the best musicians that I could possibly hope to play with. Trust me, they're phenomenal players. And we all turn up with, Simpson turns up with 2 hand-built, huge, unique, wonderful acoustic guitars. I turn up with a Martin worth $5,000, with a Zomatis worth £30,000, handmade for me in the 70s. Barry turns up with a beautiful handmade guitar and a 300-year-old violin. The double bass is a gift of when he got through the Royal Academy of Music, of a unique double bass. I mean, we got the best instruments money can buy, basically. The best microphones and the best engineer to mic us up. Why twiddle knobs? I just said to Matt, I want it to be, when they put it on their system, they've got to the sound has to be, and my voice has to be up front. I want them to hear the spittle in my voice, and I want it to be like I'm in their living room. Even the echo on my voice, if there is some, is natural. We sang it in the big open barn with the mic up close. You can hear every little in my voice. You hear little ticks in my enunciation that engineers and producers spend hours and hours trying to get rid of. I just left it there and said, leave it there. And reviews have been wonderful. They review it saying, this is a beautiful record. And, you know, and how did you do that? Well, I did it because, I don't know, I was taking a risk again, like I did in the early 70s.
I mean, back in the day, they didn't do these big productions, did they?
You're going back very early, though, David. I mean, by 65, they were recording Revolver. And then Sgt. Pepper, they were overdubbing for weeks, you know. Yeah, and in the early 70s, I was using 24 tracks and then using more. I sang all 11 songs in 1.5 days. It was just phenomenal. Yeah, well, the muse comes and sits on your shoulder just occasionally, and you have to, you know, go for it. And Matt Butler just kept saying to me, Steve, let's keep going, let's keep going, let's do another track, come on. And these guys were on fire. They were on fire. And we're all out of our comfort zones. Two of the rhythm section are both jazzers, both of them from the Royal Academy of Music, but jazz specialists. And Simpson is very roots. I've got two gospel singers. I mean, none of them, they're not mainstream pop or rock players like I am and that I'm used to being with. So we were all out of our comfort zone and just everybody just loved it. You know, everyone took turns at making the fry up for breakfast. I'd never worked like it before. I'm usually so quite might keep my distance, you know. All such lovely people. And, you know, I used to present Sounds of the 70s for about 10 years on Radio 2. And every now and again, three or four times a year, they would hear me say, yeah, you know, I'd play a Who record. And I'd say, you know, Townsend is just the kindest man you could ever wish to meet. Because I'd met him loads of times and we'd talk T.S. Eliot and Virginia Woolf. And I'd play a Wings track and say, you know, Paul McCartney can be difficult because he's a businessman and he runs things, but he's wonderful. He's great company and he's very kind to me. And I'd play a Dylan track and I could say, people find Dylan difficult, but you know, I've met him once and he sat down, he took my hand and he talked to me for 10 minutes. Well, he didn't say a word. I talked. Dylan doesn't talk, but he listened. He was so kind. And I'd say three or four times a year, you know, people who have the run, who stay the distance, who have longevity in this business, they're always, always, almost entirely without exception, good, decent, modest people.
You've done it all, you've broken every code, pulled the rebel to the floor. You spoke the game, no matter what you say, but only metal, what a ball. There's nothing left, all gone and run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while. It's just a test, a game for us to play. Win or lose, it's to smile. Resist, resist. It's from yourself.
Maybe you'll try to come up and see me to make me.